Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This week's podcast is dedicated to From the Regions, who post a review on iTunes and would like more from outside the Westminster bubble. Good news on that, we're hosting a live debate on April the 26th in Birmingham with Matthew Paris, plus the two frontrunners to be West Midlands Mayor, Labour's Sean Simon and Conservative Andy Street. Go online at mytimesplus.com for details on that. Also from the same review on iTunes, they suggested that my morning email briefing every day was too much and they'd rather have a Friday roundup to be read at leisure at the end of the day with a glass of wine in hand, which sounds lovely were it not doing me out of a job. If you can cope with reading about politics every morning, sign up to my Redbox email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox, where you'll also find details every morning in the email about that debate in Birmingham. Plus, before we get going, if you happen to want to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards, do go online to www.britishpodcastawards.com and search for Times Red Box and vote for us there. So to this week, Theresa May is in vogue, the Lib Dems are in clover and Donald Trump is still in power. Joining me to go behind the headlines are Times columnist Rachel Sylvester, award winner again at the recent British Press Awards. Reporter Grant Tucker takes a look at the Theresa May's appearance in Vogue. But we start with Giles Patel, leader writer and former Washington correspondent, who thinks Donald Trump's opponents should not get too excited.
Donald Trump is embarrassing more and more Americans. According to Gallup, 55% of them disapproved of his performance as of Sunday. This does not, however, mean his presidency will fail, much less collapse by the weekend. As long as he stands for tax cuts, deficit spending, and deregulation at home, the free world is stuck with him.
So, Giles, we keep hearing about the opponents of Trump who keep hoping that something will turn up. You know, this is going to be the smoking gun which is going to bring him down. He'll have to be. He's going to have to go. We've seen with the FBI this week, they're investigating both the links with the Trump's links with the Kremlin and what happened during the election campaign, while rubbishing the idea that Obama was wiretapping him. But none of this seems to be sticking. Is that your...
That's clear at the moment. Part of that is that Comey and Admiral Rogers of the National Security Agency on day one of the hearing were very careful to say nothing specific beyond confirming those two points. Yes, we're investigating, and no, he wasn't wiretapped. Which I suppose is what one would expect since investigations are continuing. The worry for liberals the world over is that they might actually uncover a smoking gun, a concrete piece of evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence during the election campaign, and everyone would yawn.
Yeah.
Because we've had so much that seems like that already, and he's so unconventional already, and most worryingly of all, we're used to him lying.
Yeah. So nothing sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Rachel, what do you make of this? Is there a point where he might think that he needs to do something about his disapproval ratings, or he sort of wears them as a badge of pride, so it doesn't.
Yeah, I think
even that doesn't matter.
Giles is right. He's playing politics by different rules. So I think somebody said during the presidential campaign, we're bringing fact checkers to a culture war, and the very things that the Liberals hate are the things that his supporters like. He tells it as it is. He doesn't, kowtow to the liberal mainstream media. He stands up for the little guy. And I think that a lot of the people who voted for him still probably back him on those grounds. And in a way, then what you say, who you talk to during your campaign, that's mainstream, normal political rules, and it sort of doesn't matter. But I think in terms of the world, it does matter. In real life, it does matter. So I don't think he cares, but for the stability, if you like, global stability, it is important whether what happened, what really took place, who really said what to who, and the truth.
Grant, are you still gripped by the Trump soap opera?
No, I'm completely and utterly fed up of it by now. And the interesting thing with Trump is all he cares about is ratings, but it's TV ratings, not approval ratings. And I think it's going to get to the point where journalists are going to be so bored of it, including TV journalists, where they will start to focus on different things. And maybe it's then that he'll change and go for a different strategy.
Because obviously what he really wants is attention. So he's got to be tweeting endlessly, even through the evidence session from Comey. He was sort of tweeting his comments live. And so it's this sort of like the needy child jumping up and up and down saying, look at me, look at me. So if people stop looking, that'll really freak him out.
And it's a sort of slightly lazy comparison, but the comparison with Jeremy Corbyn, who's tried to do the, who's made pretty dreadful attempts at trying to ape the sort of Donald Trump way of doing politics. But the real killer for Corbyn recently has been that Labour MPs have stopped publicly criticising him because he doesn't know what to do. Because if you define constant, if your entire existence is defined against your opponents, if your opponents stop criticising you, Corbyn's been completely at a loss.
His identity was as the victim, wasn't he, of evil Blairite attacks. Whereas if the evil Blairite attacks aren't happening, he has no identity. He's sort of a black hole of hunger, as you wrote, Matt, the other day.
He's completely obsessed with food, which is about the only thing that I think I've got in common with him. Giles, you were in America for the first 2 years of the Obama administration. It just seems a world away from that, when we'd have focused on the first 100 days and laying out a policy platform. I mean, it doesn't even seem like he's got a plan for the next 100 hours, Donald Trump.
Well, that brings us back to where we started. Actually, the congressional Republicans who are staying a bit quiet hope he has. And you can make the case that behind all the sound and fury of the Twitter storm, there are these three things that he's promised to do and hasn't yet changed his mind on. One is to spend a huge amount of money on infrastructure and defence. The other is to cut corporate tax rates by more than half, from 35 to 17%. And what's the third? The third is to deregulate the whole federal bureaucracy so that for every new regulation you scrap two, never mind whether the two that you scrap were useful for anything. Now, most of those were Republican shibboleths, have been for decades. And the thinking on the Hill is if we can make him stick to any of them, it will be worth it, even though most of them are doing it with their fingers over their over their noses. But you're right that is the only conventional politics happening at the moment, is congressional Republicans hoping to get some policy advancement out of this man.
And also, isn't that contradictory with Trump's support base? So the people who voted for him in the Rust Belt, etc., they're not going to benefit from all these reforms, are they? It's going to be the sort of wealthy and
wealthy businesses.
So there's a sort of internal contradiction there.
This kind of public spending ends up in private pockets. It's absolutely true. It goes to the private sector.
Trump would say, though, that it's people in those Rust Belt places who get the jobs to do the building, which is being paid for, ultimately, if he can point to lots of jobs being created by that, that fits the Trump narrative, doesn't it?
Yes, but it's only a narrative. One of the interesting things that's happening in corporate America is everyone is advertising their hiring policies as to curry favour with the administration, even though they're very similar to the hiring policies that would have happened anyway and have been happening for the last 8 years of continuous job growth.
Yeah, Walmart opening some new stores is not a new phenomenon, right, which is only happening under Trump, but it gets bound up in this idea that it's all thanks to this new era of Trump. Rachel, what's your take on the Theresa May, Donald Trump? We'll come on to Theresa May later, but the sort of May-Trump axis, and they're obviously... She was the first one to go to the White House. Boris Johnson, we think, is going to Washington to meet Steve Bannon. How are those relations now, do you think?
I think there's such an interesting contrast between Angela Merkel and Theresa May and their attitude to Donald Trump. And Theresa May was sort of straight in there, craven, you know, hand-holding, loving, very supportive. Angela Merkel, much more sceptical. There was that amazing photograph of her looking at askance at him as he said something about, you know, both their phones have been hacked, or words to that effect. Theresa May may end up wishing she'd been a little bit more sceptical, just because he's such a loose cannon, and she could end up getting dragged into all kinds of rows that she just shouldn't have ever been that close to.
And we hear that the state visit's now back to October. It was supposed to be June, back to October. I mean, we could easily see that slipping into next year, couldn't we?
I don't know. They gave a pretty clear commitment it was going to be this year, didn't they?
Yeah.
So that would definitely then be seen as a snub, although the Queen has a very, very busy diary, I'm sure.
But May, unlike Merkel, did come back with an exemption on the Muslim ban and came back with the first foundations of a trade deal. What did Merkel come back with?
It's true.
And she did actually also extracted, for what it was worth, the commitment to NATO, which...
I think the danger is she's being naive about the trade deal. Yeah. The trade deal will be entirely on Donald Trump's terms if it happens at all. You know, Little Britain after Brexit is not going to be front of the queue for an American trade deal.
Well, we could be at the front of a queue, but the door is shut. That's the problem. Yeah, you know, there are just other.
Or the door will be opened on their terms, you know, according to their, you know, regulations, and that could cause us problems with other countries, including the EU.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, I'm sure we'll come back to Donald Trump in the weeks to come, but let's move on now to politics closer to home. And Rachel.
The Lib Dems have 9 MPs and a brand problem, but as the voice of the Remain voting 48% after the EU referendum, they've already won a by-election and are picking up council seats all over the country. Labour donors are defecting to them, and they've doubled their membership since June the 23rd. There's a new Liberal backlash against the populist surge, and Tim Farron's party will benefit.
Now, Rachel, you've written about this in your column for The Times this week. That part of me thinks that I should find it amusing that Tim Farron is supposed to be the great white hope of British politics. But in the absence of anyone else, we should probably take it seriously. And actually, the case that you then built in your column was quite compelling. Not only have they won those the by-election, but picking up, you know, is it 34 council seats?
34 council seats.
Far more than any other party has managed. But also what was interesting was the donations in the last quarter of last year. They had more. They raised more money than the Labour Party. So big name donors.
I'm told that even in the last few weeks, a Labour donor from the Blair years has given to the Lib Dems. I wasn't told the name, but they're in talks with quite a few others. So I think you're seeing this switch of centrist, progressive, or, you know, centre-left people thinking, giving up on Labour and deciding that the Lib Dems, you know, who are absolutely unambiguously pro-European, the only kind of clearly pro-European party, national party, and they're seen now as the sort of potential way forward. I think it's interesting, there's also a sort of wider backlash, liberal backlash, if you like. You see Osborne getting the Standard, Geert Wilders being defeated in Holland, you know, even Trump with his travel ban being blocked by the courts again. And there's a sense that things went towards the authoritarian protectionist way, and there's a bit of a fight back on. And the Lib Dems are part of that.
And what was interesting, over the weekend we had another round of speculation about a snap election, which, fingers crossed, is not going to happen because we all sort of haven't recovered from last year. But what was interesting is that the Conservative MPs, particularly in the South West, are far more concerned about the Lib Dems than they are concerned about the Labour Party anyway.
I think if the election doesn't happen, it'll be much more to do with the Lib Dem threat than the Labour threat. And, you know, Theresa May knows that she was targeted for as part of their decapitation strategy in Maidenhead at one point. So she's had a sort of quite vigorous Lib Dem threat locally. And they went so low at the last election. Things can only get better, if you like, for the Lib Dems. But for the Tories, obviously, that would then change the balance of power in Parliament to give some more unambiguously pro-European, anti-Brexit MPs. And that would be quite dangerous for Theresa May.
I thought it was striking when Nick Clegg was asked about a snap election. He said, well, we can't do any worse than last time, so we'd welcome
it.
You know, bring it on, basically.
Yeah.
Giles, what do you think? Are the Lib Dems a serious electoral force?
I think so. And by the way, it's fashionable to ridicule Farron as a non-plausible leader. I think, and if I can be very cruel to him, that's more true on telly than on radio. There is something a bit sort of young and vulnerable about him in person. But I think when you just listen to what he says, if just supposing you were one of the 48%, right, it's all very plausible. And more than that, it's fighting, right? There are a lot of people in the middle who've given up, and they regard the referendum, probably quite rightly, as the people have spoken. You've got to, if you're a Democrat, you've got to respect the result. But there are others. Blair is one of them, but Blair's time has gone, who say, yes, we're Democrats, therefore the job now is to change minds. And he articulates that point of view quite well, I think.
And also, I think what's interesting is they're going beyond Europe. So they're trying to position themselves as the party of the centre, sort of stepping into that gap, if you like, in the market that has been left by Tony Blair. And you got, even in, I thought it was interesting, in the House of Lords, there are at least a dozen of the Labour peers who are the sort of more moderate end of the party who now ask every week for the Lib Dem whip's instructions because they feel they have more affinity with the Lib Dems than with Labour under Jeremy Corbyn.
Do you think this will go as far as some defecting?
I don't think, well, at the moment they're saying they don't want to defect, but they want to sort of
what about with MPs?
I don't know. It doesn't feel like it, does it? But what does feel like is they've given up on the idea of a new party.
Yeah.
So for people who aren't MPs or peers, I think you're getting quite a lot of defections among party members. Certainly anecdotally, even in Jeremy Corbyn's constituency, I'm told the Lib Dems have picked up quite a lot of new members. So people who are really cross with the Labour line on Europe particularly, but also more generally with the direction, are switching. So even if it doesn't happen at the parliamentary level, it may happen at the kind of grassroots local membership level.
Grant, are you on board with hashtag Lib Dem fight back?
Definitely not. I think this is all very fanciful. the Social Democrats' worldview has been completely and utterly devastated over the last 6 to 12 months. And they're desperately trying to cling on to something, and they've managed to cling on to the Lib Dem and Tim Farron, of all people. Tim Farron is not a new Tony Blair, at least I don't think so. And if you look at the numbers, where were the Lib Dem strongholds? It was the Southwest. They voted overwhelmingly to leave, and they are of Eurosceptic nature. So I find it very hard how they're going to win back seats there. But also, Theresa May is very popular with Tory voters. The people that should be scared of the Lib Dems are Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. I think in their areas, I don't think Theresa May has got anything to worry about by the Lib Dems. She's popular with her voters. It's the Labour Party and Labour MPs who should be worried about the Lib Dems.
And it's interesting, we've got this by-election in Manchester Gorton where Sir Joe Kaufman was the MP. And although he had something like a 24,000 majority, there's a lot of talk that the Lib Dems think they're in with a... They're definitely going to throw the kitchen sink at it like they did in Richmond. And now we've got the news that George Galloway is standing there, which could potentially split the Labour votes.
And the Labour Party there apparently is in special, put into special measures. It's utterly chaotic. They haven't even selected a candidate. It's a kind of total bum fight. And the Lib Dems think it's at least a two-horse race between Labour and the Lib Dems. And if Labour becomes too divided, George Galloway kind of splits the vote. It was a very pro-Remain constituency in the EU referendum. There's quite a lot of students. So they're hoping they could pick up support there.
And Charles, if they manage to do that, that would be an I mean, apart from the Lib Dems expanding by 25% in the House of Commons in the space of 2 years, I mean, it would show that there was, that they were a serious political force.
Yes. And I'm not the expert on recent Lib Dem parliamentary history, but when you're down in the 8, 20, 50 range, you can oscillate from one end of that spectrum to the other very easily in electoral cycles. And a win in Gorton would get their dander up. And I think, Grant, your point about the Southwest is right. They're an odd mixture of quite strong Lib Dem base and quite strong Leave vote last year. But I still think that, I mean, I hear that the Tory HQ is nonetheless worried about the yellow peril in Wessex.
Well, because before the 2010 election, I was the political editor for the Western Morning News, so I know that patch well. I'm from Somerset. And I think I was really struck in the run-up to the 2015 election. I thought if people didn't vote Tory in 2010, why would they in 2015? How wrong I was. And the reason then was obviously Nicola Sturgeon. I think the Nicola Sturgeon pulling Ed Miliband's strings played massively down there because, you know, Labour were nowhere and the idea of the SNP and Labour in cahoots was sort of too much. And, you know, they didn't just fall to the Tories by a bit. They won stonking majorities in seats which previously had been really safely held for the Lib Dems. But I think the lesson we should probably take from that isn't that that's now a safe Tory seat. It's just that politics is really volatile. And what we've seen in the last 12 months sort of
bears. And Labour's no longer a threat.
Yeah.
So the Lib Dems are, you know, could
you could
be
safely
back,
go back to the Lib Dems and you could get a potentially maybe a coalition. That might be what people thought.
If we don't have a snap election this year, and it is not till 2020 we get the next general election, I suspect that the public will be very bored of the Liberal Ramonas carrying on and on and on. And by that point, Europe would have been sorted, whether we like the deal or not. Something would have been implemented. I think this is a very short-term strategy, which will not last till the next general election.
But if what's happened, isn't it, that the EU has just given the Lib Dems an excuse to be heard. They are being heard. And then, like you say, Rachel,
well, it's given them a unique selling point.
Yes, and then they can expand.
And which they can then expand.
Other areas.
I mean, it depends whether or not at the next election Brexit is totally settled or whether the next election effectively becomes a referendum on the deal the Prime Minister's done, which we don't quite yet know. Although the other factor that somebody said to me that these, if there end up being by-elections as a result of these election expenses for Rory, the Lib Dems could be a threat in around 8 of those seats, of the sort of 20 or so seats that Tory MPs are being investigated.
So they could double in size.
In size, but I mean, Lib Dems are eternal optimists.
They are. Well, they've got to be. Let's move on and let's look at Theresa May in a glossy magazine.
Americans slicking through the pages of the latest issue of Vogue will be confronted with some eye-catching photos of Theresa May. But after ploughing through 4,000 words of breathless prose, they won't be much the wiser about the Prime Minister, apart from her dislike of being compared to Thatcher and her love of watching the brutal murders of NCIS.
I ploughed through the 4,000 words, so you don't have to. There wasn't an awful lot in. I mean, partly maybe it's because I obviously know more about the British Prime Minister than American readers of Vogue, but she didn't give very much away, and the journalist who did the interview, you could sort of feel the exasperation of her sort of saying, you know, how are things going, being the sort of opening gambit, and it was all, you know, lot to do, lots of challenges.
I did feel a bit sorry for the interviewer, because at the end she even writes that this is when the dullest people I've ever met was basically what I got from that final paragraph. She couldn't get anything out of it. It was like blood out of a stone. So now they know what British journalists have felt like for the last 6 months interviewing her on Brexit.
Rachel, you've interviewed her several times.
Yeah, she's only ever agreed to be interviewed on very specific subjects. So on we did an immigration investigation, we did an investigation into the police, and it was very, very precise, narrow, controlled. She didn't want to stray at all into kind of general chit-chat or general politics. She's a very, very difficult person to interview.
Charles, do you think this stuff matters? Prime Ministers appearing in glossy magazines and trying to, you know, give us a peek behind the curtains of what they get up to of an evening?
Not really. I think what's really troubling from Redbox coverage of this of this very, very significant cover story is is the possible retirement of the Vivienne Westwood tartan, which I really liked. I thought those billowing flares cut exactly the dash that she wanted to at Lancaster House.
So, Grant, how do you feel about the disappearance of the tartan suit?
I'm devastated. It reminded me of the Bay City Rollers, but I wasn't alive at the time, so I've only seen pictures from my dad when he was a child. What I liked about the interview as well was she's gone back to referring herself to in the third person.
Yes.
Which I'm not sure, did she ever do that with you, Rachel?
No.
There can only be ever one Margaret Thatcher, she says. I'm Theresa May. I do things my way.
And I remember during the Tory leadership contest last summer, speaking to somebody in her team, and a couple of quite senior Tory MPs had been to see her, basically to say, yes, we'll support you, but we want, what are we going to get in return? She said, I don't do deals. I'm Theresa May, and you're going to support me. And obviously, in the end, thanks to Rachel's award-winning interview with Angela Edson, congratulations for that, we never did get to find out how much that was going to matter in the end, because we didn't get the leadership contest. Does this stuff matter? Do we need to know? I mean, part of, I thought, Theresa May's appeal was we didn't have all the sort of box set playing fruit ninja nonsense that we had from David Cameron. It was just, I'm just a professional person getting on and doing the job. Why can, you know, even the Theresa May Downing Street not resist doing this sort of cuddly nonsense?
I think people do want their Prime Minister to, they want to feel they understand their Prime Minister, and because they want to feel that their Prime Minister understands them. There has to be an emotional connection of some sort. It can't just be a sort of headmistress, this is what I'm going to tell you to do. People want to feel a sense of the humanity of the person who's in charge.
And I think what's striking is her, she doesn't attempt to pander in the way that, you know, the David Cameron, but, you know, because he was so caught up on the idea that he was posh and wealthy and out of touch. She's quite happy to pose in a coat, which is several hundred pounds, or the £1,100 trousers, because that, you know, she doesn't see that there's a sort of political price to pay. So I suppose there's an authenticity there.
I think she's genuinely interested in clothes, actually.
Yes, and actually,
well,
I was striking, there is one of the better quotes in it. Have you got it there, Grant?
It doesn't stop me from going out and enjoying fashion. I also think it's important to be able to show that a woman can do a job like this and still be interested in clothes.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's...
And she does still do her own shopping. So, you know, I think some prime ministers might have a sort of personal shopper go and bring them a range of clothes, but she likes to go to the stores. She'll come back to Downing Street with her bags from Bond Street over her shoulder, slightly to the surprise of the policemen who have to accompany her.
Hanging awkwardly around the ladies' clothes
exactly.
shops.
Yeah. In the changing rooms. But she does, she's interested in shoes and clothes. One thing that I think is quite fascinating is one of her friends said to me, with the kitten heels, the first time she wore those, do you remember the leopard print kitten heels at the Tory conference, and they were on every front page, she hadn't realised it was going to be a big deal, but after that she decided that was going to be her brand, that was going to be her token interesting thing that she did. And she kind of decided to focus on it. She is interested in clothes, but she also knew, she was aware that it was going to become her brand, if you like, and that was going to be her supposedly humanizing gesture. but it's not really showing any vulnerability, is it?
That
it's
no, it actually complete, has the opposite. The cartoonists do her pinning people under a stiletto.
It's a
heel.
Suit of armour rather than a chink in the armour.
I think you're right. I think she really understands the power of clothes and power of image. And I think the reason she probably agreed to do this interview, apart from being a big fan of Vogue, which she is, she's a Desert Island Discs takeaway, is because it portrays an image of her. These photos, people laugh at them, but I think they are quite iconic in a way.
And one of the interesting things is that particularly, there's always a lot of criticism of people commenting on particularly female politicians' appearance. But her attitude seems to be, I like clothes, and she's, you know, up to a point quite happy for people to comment on it.
Yeah, no, I do think there's a sort of sexist thing in the sense that people don't comment on what men are wearing. They do comment on what women are wearing. But I think what's quite interesting with Theresa May is she's taken that and controlled it. So she's turned it around, if you like. So she's no longer the victim of that situation. She's using the clothes to her advantage. Although it backfired, obviously, with the leather trousers. But that was almost a sort of political blind spot where she hadn't realised. I'm not sure she'd thought through that they were very expensive, the leather trousers.
I think in the end it wasn't the price, it was the leather. There's something about, because the £1,200 tartan trouser suit didn't attract the same sort of attention. There was just, brown leather trousers seem a bit more out of the ordinary. Maybe that's maybe that's what it was.
She got attacked by her own side, of course, Nicky Morgan.
Nicky Morgan, exactly. But then that all became a sort of personal thing. And I think actually, plenty of people do comment on what Boris Johnson wears when he goes jogging, or David Cameron's wardrobe full of dark blue T-shirts.
His towel attempts to change under a towel.
Yes, his towel and all of that. So I think increasingly, you know, we're bringing equality to passing judgment on how people...
to hear it.
Right, I think that's all we've got time for this week. As ever, do sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. And if you get a chance, go on to iTunes where you can leave us a review, which will help us go up the charts. And if you want to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards, go to britishpodcastawards.com, search for Times Red Box, and hopefully thousands and thousands of you will vote for us, and we might even become an award-winning podcast, although don't hold your breath. But for now, from Grant Tucker, Rachel Sylvester, Giles Wattell, and me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to the...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Times.co.uk.